Welcome to episode 20 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today for a big news day by Stephanie Roy, who's a partner in Steptoe's telecom practice, by Maury Schenk, who's an advisor in our London office, specializing in telecom and internet matters, by our regular, Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now a partner in our New York office, and by guest commentator and interview subject Shane Harris, who's a journalist and author currently working at Foreign Policy magazine. I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS and record holder for returning to Steptoe & Johnson the most number of times. Let's get started. This is a hot news day, Shane, and I think you were at the press conference where the Justice Department announced that they had indicted several members of the People's Liberation Army for hacking multiple U.S. companies, stealing large quantities of very sensitive competitive information. What was the atmosphere like at the press conference?
Well, I should say I watched it online because it was sort of breaking, but it was definitely it was pretty remarkable to see this many senior officials, from the Attorney General to Assistant Attorney General Carlin, who runs the National Security Division, U.S. attorneys, coming out and just taking the gloves off with this one and really blasting the PLA, these five individuals in particular, accusing them of stealing vast quantities of information, as you said, from five American companies, marquee companies in western Pennsylvania, as well as the largest steelworkers trade union. I mean, this was really coming out and just hitting them as, this is unconscionable, this is not how serious countries behave in a globalized marketplace, and we're not going to take it anymore.
Yeah,
I felt a long time coming, you know?
John Carlin said something like, the Chinese have been telling us, give us some evidence. And he said, well, today we have it,
exactly. Yeah. And they've spelled it out in this indictment and telling, promising more indictments. I mean, they're saying that we aren't going to take this anymore. This is just the beginning. The message is clear. If you steal from U.S. companies like this, we will come after you. Quieter and less optimistic, I think, on whether these guys will actually ever see the inside of a courtroom, but they weren't backing down from the promise of bringing more indictments as well against other people, and not just in China. You know, these five actors tie back to a report from 2013, famously by the computer security firm Mandiant, about this group called Unit 61398 or Comment Crew or APT1, goes by various names, which they trace back to this one building in China. What's also remarkable in this indictment is this is now, of course, the United States government confirming essentially that, yes, that report is correct, that this is a unit operating on behalf of the PLA out of that building. They even mentioned it. So it's significant in that regard as well, I think.
Oh, yeah. No, that's remarkable. And, yeah, I'm sure this has been a long time coming because John Carlin gave interviews months ago, maybe even close to a year ago, saying, this is going to happen. And then it was radio silence for a long time. And I can just imagine what the interagency discussions were like with the entire intelligence community saying, oh, it's classified. Oh, yes, of course, it's been published, but it's still classified.
Right.
And the State Department and the Commerce Department saying, oh, dear, if we're mean to the Chinese, it might be mean to us. It's so there's an enormous effort that went into producing this, and I think it must reflect a decision at the White House that they're not getting any satisfaction out of China.
That's right. I mean, I read this as essentially saying the naming and shaming campaign that the administration has been on for a couple of years with this essentially isn't working. And, of course, the foreign policy backdrop to this being that the relationship between the United States and China is not good right now. The president went on a tour of Asia several weeks ago, recommitted to our treaty alliances, to backing up our allies in the regions, and 6 days after he left, the Chinese deployed an oil rig into territorial waters off Vietnam. And kind of created a new standoff. So, I think to some degree, if that wasn't deliberate timing of doing it now to sort of punch back at China and say, listen, we're willing to escalate this, because it will escalate the tensions in the relationship, the timing is certainly fortuitous, if that's what the administration wants to do, is not look weak. And, allies in the region have been troubled by what they see as a U.S. resolve. We had the foreign minister of Singapore in our offices at Foreign Policy last week, and in a very diplomatic way, as you'd expect for the foreign minister of an ASEAN country, said, we're wondering, are you guys essentially, can you back up your commitments in the region? Can you pass this Trans-Pacific Partnership Pact? The subtext being that as the United States seems to look weak in the eyes of those people against China, they're starting to question our resolve in other areas, which the administration doesn't want.
I can't resist saying that only this administration would think that they show resolve by throwing prosecutors at the problem. I welcome this, but the idea that it has geopolitical is a geopolitical demonstration of resolve misreads Asia, I think. But that said, the guys that they went after,
because the Bush administration would have invaded China? Is that the contrast you're drawing?
And we would have made up the evidence, too. I just don't think that anybody thinks that this is going to change the strategic balance. That's a military question, and there's a big military challenge from China to the United States and the Fifth Fleet, Seventh Fleet. That requires that you spend actual money on the Defense Department, which is something that has been harder to get the administration to do.
To me, it's a lot like the response to Russia's invasion and acquisition of Crimea. They had to institute the sanctions, but no one's under any illusions that they're actually going to have any effect on Putin's behavior. And I think the same thing here. They had to do something, but I doubt they're under the illusion that this is going to stop the Chinese from engaging in economic espionage.
No, I think that's right. It's better than nothing for sure, and it has a lot of collateral benefits and some collateral risks as well. But the guys that they indicted, at least some of them, one of them, Ugly Gorilla, whose name has become more famous maybe than his talent deserves, had a blog that I think the New York Times published, and maybe Mandian had published it as well, in which he bemoaned the fact that he was stuck in some stupid suburb doing dumb work, and he couldn't wait to find an opportunity to start making money like the other guys who went to technical school with him. Those guys, a lot of them aspire to a career in the internet economy, and it's kind of hard to raise money in Silicon Valley if you're under indictment in the United States. So I think this may turn out to be more of a disincentive than we think. These guys are 30 years old, and they've got a lifetime of dodging red notices ahead of them.
Right, right. One of the collateral benefits to this, it was hard to miss given how Attorney General Holder led off with this, is post-Snowden, the NSA has been taking a lot of heat for, do they engage in economic espionage, right? And, of course, as you know, the line is like, look, we do not spy on corporations for the benefit of American corporations. And Holder went to great lengths this morning to sort of brand this Chinese spying as that kind of spying.
Right.
And say, this is done for the benefit of corporations, and this cannot be tolerated. And so, it allows them to sort of say, look, we don't engage in that kind of thing. That's what the Chinese do. And to back that up with a criminal indictment.
Well, and to pivot a little, Glenn Greenwald has been doing his best to try to undermine any moral high ground that the U.S. could claim by charging, and Snowden has done it too, by saying, well, the U.S. engages in economic espionage, and they broke into Petrobras, and they broke into some of these other commercial enterprises, sort of trying to muddy the distinction between figuring out what the likely production of oil in the world will be and figuring out what price Petrobras is going to bid for offshore oil leases against Exxon. I'm sure we'll see more from him, but it is kind of nice to have a second line of discussion, because this is the kind of thing where people will want to see the evidence, and real stories with real evidence make a big difference in the policy debate. So, yeah, it's very exciting. Any other thoughts on what this means diplomatically?
You know, it'll be interesting to see the Chinese response. It's usually, I'm guessing, it'll be the standard boilerplate response of these accusations are baseless. Whether or not the Justice Department will now try and push through its legal attachés or whatever sort of conduits that we have over there, meaningfully push to get these individuals brought to a U.S. court, will be very interesting. And I don't know, I'm not as familiar with the Chinese, you know, sort of judiciary system such that it is, but it'll be interesting to see if there's any formal response on their part about
this. We don't have a extradition treaty with them for obvious reasons, because we wouldn't want to send back people they consider criminals in many cases. They have said from time to time, just show us the evidence, and you know, we're a victim too, and we oppose hacking. It's going to be a little tougher to argue that here. My guess is that sometime in the next year, they're going to indict somebody in the United States.
That's what I was saying.
Keith Alexander.
We'll have to cancel any trips to China that he might be as a consultant, which he is now.
Maybe they can offer Snowden an opportunity to be a witness. this could all bring everything together.
I fly to China to cover that.
Yes. The question is, can you get back from China after covering that? That kind of brings us to This Week in NSA, and This Week in NSA is not especially newsworthy, but there are a few things. It's been the conventional wisdom that none of the telephone companies, the traditional telcos, actually challenged the 215 program. But now it turns out that at least two of the three, Verizon and Sprint, raised questions and demanded more in the way of legal action and justification for this. We found out last week that Sprint had also raised questions about the 215 program, but didn't carry it so far as to litigate and appeal the matter, but it did demand more action from the court, the FISA court, and got it. Glenn Greenwald's book is out, I'm pleased to say that some public-spirited person who believes in openness has leaked it to BitTorrent, and in 32 seconds you can download it for free. And of course, it's a violation of law to do that, just as it's a violation of law to leak national security secrets. I would suggest you let your conscience be your guide in deciding whether that's an appropriate step to take. He hasn't made too much in the way of news with the book. It's mostly the story, or at least the first half of it, and apparently the better half, is the story of how he got in touch with Snowden. Release something that he's been talking about before, but with more details about the fact that NSA modifies equipment that's being sold outside the United States before it leaves. They apparently not with the cooperation of companies. They just break into the warehouse, modify the equipment, put a seal back on it, and send it. The press take on that has been, oh, dear, the U.S. has been accusing China of doing stuff like this, and now it turns out the U.S. is doing it too. Isn't that shocking? It's a little like saying, or we're shocked to think that the U.S. opposes militarization in China because the U.S. has a military too. I think the real problem with what the Chinese is doing is just how aggressive it is and how unready we are for that kind of activity. That's it for This Week in NSA. Michael, I get the sense that LabMD is slowly losing its options as it fights with the FTC over its standards for security. Is it really down to just one last shot here, which is actually playing on the FTC's own turf to try to persuade one of its ALJs that LabMD didn't do anything wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say we now do This Week in LabMD every week because they've had this shotgun approach to trying to bring the FTC down. And, you know, realistically, none of these attempts to forestall the FTC's administrative proceedings ever had much of a chance. And so their last civil suit brought in the federal district court in Georgia was dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. And just as the 11th Circuit did, it dismissed because the FTC hasn't finished its administrative proceedings yet, and you can't normally bring a challenge in court to an administrative action until the administrative action has been completed. And so this week, the ALJ at the FTC will start hearing the evidence of LabMD's security and why the FTC considered it inadequate and therefore an unreasonable practice. So, you know, the next step will be the ALJ's decision, and that will be appealed to the full commission. Full commission would likely uphold the determination, and then it would go to a court of appeals, and I imagine LabMD will take it back to the 11th Circuit. But you never know. You know, the ALJ could rule in LabMD's favor.
On something, or yeah, that you're right.
Yeah, on the ground that you know, its security wasn't really all that bad, or it couldn't have foreseen that an employee would download LimeWire and make personal information of patients publicly available. But it seems like a long shot.
Yeah, the problem with this case, in a sense, is it's like trying to figure out whether Kelly Clarkson was a great singer on a particular date. You know, there was a time when nobody'd heard of her, and then there was a time when everybody'd heard of her, and then there's a time when a few people still remember her. Worrying about LimeWire as a security flaw in your system, it was a big deal for about 6 months, and then people stopped using LimeWire, and the whole issue went away. And so the real question is, where in that LimeWire hype cycle was LabMD's compromise? Too early for them to have realized that it was a problem, or at a time when they absolutely should have known that there was something to worry about?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't remember, you know, when LimeWire became a big deal. But there have been previous cases where peer-to-peer software was downloaded onto a company system and personal information was lost as a result. So even if it wasn't LimeWire, it could have been something else that arguably put LabMD and other companies on notice that this was something to worry about.
Yeah. Well, and my apologies to any Kelly Clarkson fans who are offended. I actually love her stuff.
I was listening to her on the way up.
There you go.
Okay. She's on my playlist.
All right.
No, I remember her.
Yeah. She had a booming voice. She was great. And pretty good at picking tunes. Michael, I understand. Michael is a very talented Supreme Court lawyer. And he was trying for the Supreme Court equivalent of drawing to a straight flush by trying to get the court not just to take a case, but to take the case and summarily reverse it. Getting the court to take a case, about 100 people do that a year, but there must be only 20 or 25 who can get the court to actually take and reverse a decision. And I bet him $5 that there was no way he was going to do that. Michael, do I owe you money?
You do. You owe me $5. This morning, the court granted our petition and vacated the decision of the Fifth Circuit. The case involved a young man who was arrested by the police, was handcuffed, lying face down on the ground, and they ordered him to stand up and walk to the squad car. And when he didn't, they electroshocked him with a taser. And they did this again and again and again, a total of eight times, at least eight times that they shocked him. Five of the shocks came within 85 seconds. So it's pretty clear from the fact that they weren't actually giving the guy a chance to get up. They just kept shocking him maliciously, in my view. The person died shortly after the last tasing. So his son, his very young son, brought a 1983 action on the ground that the father's Fourth Amendment rights were violated. The Fifth Circuit found that the cop had qualified immunity because it wasn't clearly established that this sort of tasing was unconstitutional. And we raised a number of issues to the Supreme Court seeking cert, and we offered them, you know, an easy way out, which was, look, the Fifth Circuit didn't even read the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, i.e. the plaintiff, which is an axiom, you know, it's an axiom that's the way you're supposed to read the facts when a party moves for summary judgment, because it wasn't even clear that the decedent could even get up, was physically capable of get up. There was testimony that he was not able to get up, at least after the first several tasings, that he couldn't get up even if he wanted to. And so the case now goes back to the Fifth Circuit for them to determine whether it was clearly unconstitutional that you can't shock a person who is not able to follow your command, which seems like a no-brainer. And so hopefully we end up back at trial and we get a day in court for our plaintiff client.
No dissents?
No. This was it was just an order, basically. And these are usually per curiams when they do an opinion. In this case, they didn't even need to write an opinion because they very recently vacated a decision from the same circuit on the same ground. And it's just not, you know, when they're basically just saying the lower court messed up here and they're not deciding a new legal issue. It's barely worth writing an opinion. And here, since they've done something similar recently, it wasn't even worth writing a short per curiam.
So if I can bring this back to the subject of our podcast, if he'd been shot with a traditional weapon, we would never know that he'd been shot five times in 85 seconds. So this is the result, in part, I think, of big data. It's just easy and cheap to keep track of how frequently the taser is used and to maintain that record inside the device, I assume.
Yeah, exactly. The taser keeps a record of exactly what time it was deployed, how long the shock was being given, and I think it also tracks the voltage, but I'm not sure. That might be a standard thing. But, yeah, it's pretty – in this case, it's especially damning because this is not a matter of testimony. It's you know, an undeniable printout from the taser.
Wow.
Oh, well, congratulations again, and I will give you the $5 when I see you next. And the last thing before we get to net neutrality, I see the Justice Department found time between indicting PLA members to release a white paper that makes it at least a little clearer that there's some kinds of information sharing that the Justice Department considers legal. This is sort of a part of a series because they did one with the FTC on when the antitrust laws permit information sharing. Did you look at that one?
I did, and, you know, it's not a big deal legally, just like the previous antitrust opinion was, because the conclusion is kind of obvious. You know, I remember back when I was at the FBI and we were urging companies to share information with us, threat information, vulnerability information, and also with each other. There were concerns raised about, oh, this might violate the antitrust laws if we share information with other companies, and we're not sure if this is legal. And to me, it was obviously a bogus argument just raised as an excuse not to share back then. And finally, 16 years later, the department has issued opinions now saying, yes, there really is no antitrust issue here, so you can share freely, and this does not violate the Stored Communications Act if you share information that's de-identified, that you're not identifying a particular user. when you share information.
So you have to aggregate it. There was kind of a lame argument that maybe that was that was information as well about your subscribers, and that it wasn't perfectly clear that aggregated information could be shared, even though you couldn't think of any reason why it wouldn't be shared. And this does lay that to rest more or less.
Right. I agree. So, you know, hopefully it has a positive impact on information sharing, but since the concern was never really valid in the first place, in my opinion, I'm not sure it will make much of a difference.
Okay, well, let's talk about what happened last Thursday. Stephanie Roy is here, does a lot of our telecommunications practice. After an immense buildup and everybody condemning regs they hadn't seen, and a mobilization of the internet on behalf of outrage and some cause or other, they finally produced a set of proposed regs.
They did.
And they voted 3-2, the narrowest possible margin, to put them forward, with two of the three saying, you know, I'm not sure I like this, but what the heck, let's put it out there. Is that right?
Oh, that's true, but in their defense, or in Chairman Wheeler's defense, I would say the two of the three, because they actually wanted more aggressive regulations proposed than that which appear in the NPRM. Actually, there was a great deal of last-minute amendment to the proposed rules.
Do we know what those changes were?
We don't know precisely what those changes were. There's a very kind of strict hold on the internal deliberations of the FCC commissioners before they come out, and we don't. Sunshine Act, it's not part of that. We can't see those, but it's very clear that obviously that Commissioners Pai and O'Reilly wanted fewer rules proposed, and Commissioners Rosenworcel and Clyburn wanted more assertive language, perhaps on Title II, perhaps in other aspects. We can't know for sure. The statements make it clear of which direction each commissioner was going in.
So the big choice here was, are we going to try to give up on net neutrality, which I assume was the Republican position, or are we going to do it under Section 706?
That's right.
Or under Title II?
That's right.
What's the difference between them?
Well, Section 0706 is relatively broadly worded piece of what Verizon Court said was actually does exist as an independent grant of FCC authority, basically to take actions to promote the infrastructure investment and the advancement of advanced telecommunications capability throughout the country. The limiting factor there is that they cannot regulate pursuant to that section of the Act in a way that violates other sections of the Act. And they're not allowed to regulate, as a common carrier, anybody or any service that they have not classified as a common carriage service.
Mm-hmm.
And as a common carrier, engaged in a common carrier service. And so far they haven't done that with internet access services. And the way that they put forth the no blocking and the anti-discrimination rules, the court said, smacked, in their face of common carriage, and so were not permissible, but that they did have authority to promulgate rules under Section 706. Of course, Title II is the standard common carriage regulation regulated as a telecommunications utility, like the plain old telephone service, POTS, as we call it. There's a lot of political angst over whether or not to regulate it as a common carrier service. Of course,
wouldn't they have to throw out about 3/4 of Title II to get to net neutrality?
You mean forbear, Stuart?
Forbear, yes.
Yes.
Forbear.
Yes, they would have to. And they've said that they propose to forbear from many of the common carrier tools available to the FCC under the Communications Act. But in fact, the FCC has already chosen to forbear from many of its common carriage tools for other common carrier services under its rules. So it's nothing new and it's nothing novel, actually. Matter of fact, they actually are required by the Telecommunications Act of 1996 to engage in forbearance where they find it feasible to do so.
But knowing exactly what that's going to mean is going to be a
Well, the devil's in the details. Yes. That's right. Okay. The devil's in the details, and it's approximately a 60-page NPRM. They've given a relatively lengthy comment period. The parties have until July 15th to comment, and then until September 10th to do some reply comments. We expect a very voluminous record. And they have teed up the Title II. They've done a couple things. They've teed up the Section 706 versus Title II question relatively well throughout the entire piece. And they've also teed up the question of really how to treat what they are characterizing as the Internet access provider service to the edge provider. There's been some proposals to the FCC that characterize the one of the issues before the Verizon court was whether or not you could have a two-sided market. The Verizon court, the FCC's opinion was no, the broadband access provider's customer was the individual consumer, not the edge provider. And the Verizon court said, well, if they're not a common carrier, which you said that they're not, you can't tell them they can't have another side of their market.
The question here, I guess, is the nightmare for consumers is that they'll start being treated the way customers in cable companies are treated, which is we're not going to deliver this particular piece of content to you because they haven't paid us enough, notwithstanding that you're paying it.
Or they're delivering all these streams of prioritized traffic such that there's actually no bandwidth left for
right.
people who haven't paid.
So if I understand it, I mean the goal of most of the people who want more regulation here is to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Yes, they are looking to make sure that ISP can't pick winners or losers and can't dedicate its bandwidth to those people who pay them a lot of money. And or prioritize their affiliated content, which is a significant concern with the pending merger of Comcast Time Warner of many parties.
So if either of these provisions strike me as opening the door to regulation not just of the carriers but to the edge providers, that is to say, once you say, I'm going to say that this is a field in which there's common carriage, you can apply those rules to anybody who's using that service, not just the people who are providing the pipes, right?
Well, not so much, because somebody who's using the service, the obligation is on the common carrier under Title II,
but
right?
But if they say the Internet is subject to common carriage rules, then they can say, and we found some common carriers who say they're edge providers.
But it's limited by the definition of what a telecommunication service is in, under the communications.
So if I'm offering over-the-top phone service?
You're not providing a... you're transporting the content of somebody else's choice from end to end, and that's not really, I think, extractable to apply to an edge provider because it's not a communication originated by the customer.
Suppose the edge, I'm providing Internet service, I'm an ISP, and somebody decides to offer a voice application over the top. And I say, well, I don't like that. They're competing now with my voice service. I go to the FCC and say, those guys should be treated like common carriers, too, because they're providing the same service that common carriers have always provided. That's at least now open once you've opened the Title II.
Well, if all you're doing is transporting content originated by somebody else to the between the points that somebody else designates, then, yes, that's potentially a Title II service, just like VoIP.
Right.
Has been treated. But I think it's a big leap to
yes.
take that to the Netflixes and Amazons and Hulus of the world.
Yes.
And evidently they're not too concerned about that at this point because they've been very vocal advocates of pretty strong net neutrality regulations, Netflix point in fact.
So one of the questions I've been thinking about since this is also a security and law enforcement podcast is, do either of those open the door to more regulation of people who provide Internet services to say, by the way, you have a social responsibility to make sure that criminals are not using your service without being subject to wiretaps or other kinds of information gathering? You need to design in systems that allow the police in the right case to get access to the information. Either of these would at least open that possibility, wouldn't it?
Well, I mean, that's kind of like saying that I think the FCC, because they have a broad public interest mandate, is open to those types of arguments. But I think we've seen that there's usually a specific statutory requirement for the FCC to act in a way to require communications companies to open up their networks to law enforcement like CALEA, and to interface with those types of requirements. And there's nothing you'd have to say that it's a pretty strong hook to try to say that the FCC's responsibility under Section 706, for example, to advance a build-out of infrastructure for advanced telecommunication service to all Americans. That's a pretty attenuated connection to that, I think. I think you'd have to look for separate statutory authority.
Okay. Well, we'll see. I think once you've got people lobbying you for benefits,
calling into question the entire public interest benefit analysis that the FCC.
I'm not calling it into question. I'm just saying that maybe the benefits won't turn out to be the benefits that the companies are entirely sure they want. What's the politics of this? It's obviously this was Chairman Wheeler's initiative. He did the drafting. He seems to be the guy who has, everybody else has the luxury of saying, well, this isn't quite the way I would have done it. But does he have 3 votes for whatever comes out of this process, do you think?
I think especially if he takes care, especially with the pay prioritization element, which a lot of players that even favor Section 706 under Title II want the commission to find a way to guard against what they see as any incentives to deter competition that way, or to act in a way that would actually, over the long term, decrease competition on the edge provider space. I think so long as that's addressed that way, he'll probably have 3 votes. I don't think that he's getting the other 2
right.
Anytime soon. But as long as they can wrap this up while we still have 3 Democratic commissioners, I think that it has a good chance of passing.
And from the point of view, there are people who say, really, you're trying to take statutory language that wasn't meant to cover this, no matter what you're talking about, Title II, 706, to achieve this goal, you should let Congress write the rules. Is there any hope that Congress is going to take this issue on?
I don't think so. They have been looking at a Telecom Act rewrite for the last 9 months or so, and the House has got some proposals on the table, but the Senate has been much more deliberate or have other priorities at the moment, and Senator Rockefeller is retiring at the end of this term. So you're going to have some, even if the Senate swings, this fall, like I think everyone acknowledges there's a good chance that we'll do so. There's going to be some settling in phase, on the other side of the chamber, of the Congress. And, we're looking, there was a question put to a lot of people actually at this, weekend's, communications biannual seminar, and people estimated, 4 to 5 years out.
I remember when I was trying to get, from an NPRM to a final in the government, when I had all the wind behind me, the interagency lined up, the White House wanted it, the department wanted it, 18 months. We were booking it. And so the likelihood that this is going to get done in the next 2 years is pretty...
Well, I think the rules, but the question is, can... a congressional, telecom update.
Oh, that's where
that's years out.
Yes.
That's years out, right?
I'm
so I don't
sure
think Congress is going to override.
You think this reg's going to get done in 2 years?
Yeah, if Chairman Wheeler has anything to do with it, definitely.
Okay. All right. Well, that will be interesting. All right. That's only one of the hot issues. Let's turn to the other. The European Court of Justice produced a remarkable decision that Maury Schenck, I think, quite accurately compared to the most aggressive judicial activism of the Warren Court in the United States in the 60s. Maury, what did they actually say, and then what does it mean?
Well, they said 4 main things. They talked about who's a data controller, and they found that Google's a data controller with respect to its search results, so it's subject to European data protection law, not just for this right to be forgotten, but for other purposes. They said that there's
that's wacky right there, isn't it? That's a big change from what people had understood about data controllers, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've thought Google's activity is subject to data protection law, but the fact that for all of their search data, they're subject to it. I mean, you could imagine, you know, other things like making sure search results are accurate, and what does that mean? So it's, I think we'll see more on that front.
That would make me a data controller every time I link to something in a blog post, wouldn't it?
Well, you're not in Europe. Stuart, you're probably happy about that, but...
I am happy about that, but didn't they have a second decision that said, you don't have to be in Europe, Baker, we'll get you anyway?
Well, what they said in Google's case was, even though the search data was processed, we're not sure where, because Google has Google Spain, and they're established, and that's a company that's selling advertising, we can get your search data even if it's not processed here, and that's a pretty striking thing as well, because the Data Protection Directive says explicitly it applies to processing in Europe. So that's pretty remarkable as well. The other two things they said are that when you're considering an erasure request like this guy Gonzalez in Spain made, number one, a data protection authority can require erasure even where the underlying information is legally published and still may be published. They can require Google to delete the search results. And second, and the one that's gotten the most attention, is that they said when balancing whether to require deletion of the search results, you can have a right to be forgotten. You know, too much time has passed, and that's a reason why the search result ought to be deleted.
If I remember right, they said, you don't need to say I'm prejudiced by this. You just need to say, I don't think it's relevant anymore.
Well, you have to say that my rights of privacy, my rights not to have my publicly available information continue to be processed, exceed any remaining public interest in being able to process, which might include a right of free expression and publication of information, but not the kind of prejudice that you would think about, probably.
So didn't I see a suggestion that they were limiting the question of the balancing to the individual's human rights and Google's tawdry interest in making a little bit of money? There was some suggestion that the relevance inquiry was supposed to be in the context of what Google did with it.
Sure, this is Michael. I think you're right. The court did say that the result might be different if the plaintiff were a public figure of some sort, which would increase the newsworthiness of the item. But in this case, you know, the news was old. The person apparently wasn't a public figure, and this just involved what seemed basically like a foreclosure matter in his distant past.
None of this sounds like it's particularly administrable. If you're Google, what do you do when somebody says, I'd like to have this taken down? I gather that about half of the people who've asked to have stuff taken down are criminals and sex offenders, at least judging from a Daily Mail story I saw.
Yeah, well, I think the bad guys with money, you know, public figures, Silvio Berlusconi may not benefit too much from this, but bad guys with money will be the ones who will benefit the most from this. I think in terms of administrability also, you know, there's 28 data protection authorities in the 28 EU member states that will decide what has to come down. The Spanish authorities, who are the ones who are the respondent in this case, are among the most aggressive. They'll probably want all kinds of stuff to come down. And, you know, the UK, I'm guessing they'll shade more towards freedom of expression.
But it won't matter because of if the Spanish say take it down, the Brits are not going to see it, right?
Yes, although it'll depend who has jurisdiction. So if it's an individual in Spain, I think they'd have a hard time complaining to the UK authorities, and vice versa. A UK person probably couldn't go forum shopping.
And the notion that there should only be one data protection regulator for foreign companies, is that going to go out the window?
Well, that's one of the streamlining proposals that in the new data protection regulation, which has been delayed now into the next parliament. So, and they were debating the right to be forgotten there. Everybody assumed that that would be something that had to be legislated, that could not be imposed by the court. So all of these things might be considered again in the context of the new data protection regulation over the next couple of years.
Yeah, and you seem pretty confident that Google can just refer these requests to the data protection authorities and wait for them to rule. But if it's a violation not to erase when something is out of date, by the time the data protection authorities get to it, it will have been out of date for a long time if they decide that it's out of date. And then they can impose fines, I assume, right?
Well, I agree. I agree with you. What I'm saying is the data protection authorities will be the initial deciders, but Google will have to have its own processes because you're absolutely right. They could be fined if they're found to have violated people's rights, people's right to be forgotten.
And the maximum fine under the proposed legislation is how much?
Well, at the moment, it's country by country. In the UK, it's £500,000. They were going to have a turnover-based amount under the new data protection regulation.
So 2% of your annual revenue, right?
Yeah, so it could go much higher in the future. Right now, it's not that high, but, you know, you get fined £500,000 times the number of violations, even Google starts to care.
Yeah, I think that's right, which argues, if you're doing this on the inside, for just taking down everything, because there's really no risk in taking it down other than that your searches start to get kind of Swiss cheesy. But the alternative, the regulatory consequences are pretty hefty if you make a mistake of leaving it up.
Yeah, well, it depends whether Google still believes do no evil. You know, I mean, sitting here in Europe, we believe in free expression quite as much as in the States where there's the First Amendment. But one would hope that those concepts are something Google thinks about rather than just giving into this completely.
Yeah, well, the problem is there's two different versions of evil at work here. The Europeans, the Europeans define evil by using Google's logo, if I remember right. But they would say, oh, this is the rights of man. You know, that's the most important possible result. In the U.S., we'd say, well, this is interfering with our rights of free expression. So either way, they're going to be doing so what somebody considers evil.
Yeah, no, it's a tough balance. One got the impression that this court didn't, it almost seemed naive they went so far, but that they didn't think very hard about, all joking aside, what is a tough balance here in Europe as well, and which I think is going to hurt European internet industry because most internet services can be delivered from anywhere, and particularly new businesses are going to be more reluctant to be in Europe with this kind of aggressive data protection regulation.
I think you're right to some extent, although, you know, my experience with European regulators is they only really apply this law aggressively to American companies. That's probably a little unfair, but they certainly are much more aggressive about it if they think they can also get a mercantilist benefit from their enforcement. It does seem to me that the reasoning here says that if you link to something, you're a controller of that data. That has to be. That's what the search engines are doing. They're linking. Maybe they're also searching and identifying, but of course I do that too. When I want to link to something, it's because I went out and found it and read it, and then I link to it. So that would make me a data controller with respect to that link, and the link does not have to come down. I can be sued separately from the guy who posted it and held responsible for refusing to take it down. So that almost anybody who engages in any activity on the internet that involves looking at data and transmitting other people's views is now responsible for the accuracy and the relevance of those views under, you know, in the view of a bunch of judges who, as far as I can tell, are clinically insane.
Aside from the point about clinical insanity, I think you're right. I mean, the court was definitely saying that it has to be more than linking, but it's the processing and linking of the search to the link. But like you say, almost any processing with almost anything involving a link would involve some sort of processing. So yes, it's a shockingly broad decision.
So that does mean that anybody in Europe who does that is at risk, and it'll just fall from the sky on them as liability. But I'm not sure you're better off moving to San Francisco, because under the interpretation here, if you do any business in Europe, you're going to be subject to jurisdiction, including the jurisdiction of the right to be forgotten.
That's right, as a strict legal matter. I think from a business perspective, and the reason why you perceive European authorities as being more aggressive against U.S. companies is that for a company based in Europe, it's very hard to have aggressive data processing practices. So some of the stuff that Facebook does is genuinely controversial under EU law, not under a very broad reading of this decision, but genuinely controversial. And I think it's hard to push the limits from within the borders of the EU.
I guess that's right. And there's just not an infrastructure set up for using the data or making money off the data. And all of that discourages people from doing social media in Europe until they see a business model that they know works and can be squared with European law that they can imitate. And by then, it's a little late, because the American startup is probably already eating their European market. Yep, I can see how this works. It's fascinating. I don't know. The United States adopted a law that said if you sue an American, if I remember right, in Britain for libel — this was an anti-libel tourism law — we will not only not enforce it, but we're liable to allow the person who is subject to that judgment to get an offsetting judgment here in the United States. Do you see any possibility for a fight between lawmakers over this, in which the United States says, not only is Google never going to pay a fine for this, we will fine that guy, Gonzalez or whatever his name was, Gonzalo, every dollar that he gets in damages from Google, he'll have to pay back in a lawsuit in the United States. Do you see the likelihood of that kind of blocking action by the U.S.?
Well, I think that might be more a question for you all sitting in the U.S. than me here in London, but I would say yes, maybe, but it'll take a little while to unfold. I mean, Google said in a few weeks they're going to come out with an initial proposal how they propose to deal with this, and I think that there will probably be some negotiations, some back and forth, maybe the Working Party 29, which is the group of EU data protection authorities, will get together and think about how this might be administered. People will talk to Google, and we'll see how bad it actually is before people get involved in legislative blocking efforts.
Shane, what's your sense about the relative status of U.S.-EU diplomacy over these issues, and do you think this is going to drive a wedge between the two jurisdictions?
It sure seems like it could. I mean, you know, you just made me think of, I know there are instances where American journalists have been sued by foreign parties for libelous statements that they made that were considered libel under their country, and I know lawyers who've actually countersued under the Anti-SLAPP Act and
right.
won. So, I mean, I would think that, you know, if you're Google, and you're hoping that the United States is generally in favor of your interests as a business in the world and a global company, that you would hope that it would stand up for you.
I think it's tough for Google to do this. It was easier for journalists in general to get behind this. Google's so big and so controversial even in the United States that something that seems designed just to help out Google and maybe a few other smaller search engines might be harder to pass.
Yeah, and they're not necessarily, you know, seen in the best light right now, to the extent that the people think they've been collaborating with the NSA and all of this, which I feel like, I mean, I know that the idea of the right to be forgotten precedes Snowden. Jeffrey Rosen wrote a paper on this in 2012, but it certainly feels like, I'm not I'm following the internal politics in the EU closely, but it certainly feels in a lot of ways like a reaction to this idea that the that Google and Facebook have become just too powerful.
I think that's a very common view in Europe.
Yeah. We joked in the office that this shouldn't be called the right to be forgotten, but the right to be forgiven, because it really seems like the idea that after 5 years, you know, any embarrassing pictures you put of yourself on the internet, the statute of limitation should apply. And
I'm all for that. Yeah, it's, I must say, I find it sort of inconceivable that this, free-floating liability lasts forever, but, you know, that is the whole style of data protection law. Everything's illegal, it's just a question of which illegalities they choose to enforce. Europe has gotten pretty comfortable with that, maybe because the enforcement, discretion has mostly hurt, companies that end up in the newspaper and American companies. You can do almost anything to Google and maybe to Facebook and get support from the elites in Europe, whose views are shaped by the media, who feel most threatened by those guys.
We started this talking about China, and I do a fair amount of business there, and in Russia, and those are countries where laws that are absolutely broad but only get enforced when they really want to go after somebody is the norm. One doesn't expect that as much in Europe. I'm a proud European now, but you're right that this is kind of an example of that, and it's frightening.
Yeah, it's only the Anglo-Saxons that find that objectionable, as far as I can tell. Most of the civil law jurisdictions are pretty comfortable with it. Your mention of China does remind me that there is a First Amendment search case here in the U.S. That says Baidu can refuse to tell anybody that anything interesting happened in Tiananmen Square in 1989. And when you search for it in the for Tiananmen Square in 1989 in the United States on Baidu, you don't get anything interesting. The courts have held that Baidu has a First Amendment right to give you bad search results. So the irony here is that all the other jurisdictions in the world can say what Google cannot tell us, but Google has no obligation and indeed a First Amendment right to obey those, no obligation to resist that, and a First Amendment right to obey that kind of government censorship as long as it isn't the U.S. government that's doing it. So we're going to live in a world, ironically, where the preconceptions and the desires of every government except the United States is going to end up reflected in our search engines, especially as the assertion of jurisdiction goes global.
You can imagine like an add-on in your browser that flags what country the search result emanated from. You know,
it's so one of the things I actually kind of be interested in doing, if we could find somebody who wanted to fund this, maybe I'll go on Kickstarter, is to start a website that has all of the censored results. Right? Anything that you might want to see that isn't that some government has said no, you can't see it, would be available there. I'd have to set it up as a Delaware corporation that did no business anywhere, but wouldn't make any money. And then put it on the web and let people go there. If Pirate Bay can last as long as it has, I'm guessing this organization could last just as long. We may have to do that. We'll talk to the First Amendment Foundations and see if they'll fund it. Shane, we've taken up a lot of time, and I wanted to get to a bunch of things that you have been doing. And you've talked a lot and you've studied a lot the effort to regulate the trade in zero-day vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. And it's clear that that's having some impact on the administration's thinking. Can you give me a sense of what you think the state of play is in that area?
Well, it seems like they've carved out this broad exception to a on its face a policy that the NSA should be generally in the business of disclosing vulnerabilities that it is the first or among the first to find in hardware or software, but that there should be this national security exception, which seems very, very broad and largely designed to ensure that the NSA is not put out of the business of acquiring that information for defensive purposes and particularly for offensive purposes. So it seems like that's where the sort of the state of play is now. And I'm really not that confident that it's evolved much beyond that. I mean, when the presidential advisory panel on NSA came back with their recommendations, including on the 215 program on PRISM, you know, there was this recommendation to basically stop acquiring and hoarding zero-day vulnerabilities and to disclose them. And that really went nowhere. And it right. wasn't really until the Heartbleed story came out that the administration sort of came out and said, oh, well, we've also been looking at this more closely. Because, you know, when you asked them that at the beginning, they said, oh, we'll get to that.
Right.
And suddenly now, oh, it's much more
further
along.
We've already decided not to do
right,
that.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And there's this national security exception. Which
I think Mike Riley wrote that story, and offered the view that the story's wrong. It's a lie. He wasn't lying. He didn't know, but he went with a story that just wasn't true and has been pretty effectively debunked since then. So it's a false story, and yet it seems to have had a significant impact on policy. At least it surfaced this new policy, and so it has to be the most effective false story published in the papers. In
right,
the
it forced a clarification of a policy that's not very advanced. Right. Yeah. But you know, I keep thinking. I mean, if I were writing this, you know, as a screenplay or something, you know, you can imagine a day in the future when the future head of the NSA is sitting there before a Senate committee at the Greenfelt table and somebody says, you know, after the Pearl Harbor or whatever you want to call it we just had, why did you not disclose to the American public that you knew the vulnerability that the Chinese got in through?
This is a complete replay of Pearl Harbor, right?
Sure. I mean, exactly.
The president
we
knew.
Really did know this time.
He wanted us to be
right,
attacked.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that's been interesting to me, and I'm writing about this more in a book I have coming out in November, but, you know, we talk about NSA hoarding this data, and the narrative really since post-Snowden has been about sort of all of the efforts that NSA and the government makes to try and control information and control the data space. We don't talk as much about the extraordinary risks that they're taking when they do that, that the possibility that you have a vulnerability that you don't disclose, that some other bad guy out there does find out about it, because, you know, in a black market where you're buying these things, they could be being sold to multiple customers.
Right.
There's no regulatory agency for black market zero-day vulnerabilities. So what happens
it's sort of a eBay-type reputation
yeah.
system, right? If you sell it multiple times, sooner or later people find out, and your reputation goes down, they won't do business.
Right, and there was a great report that just came out from Rand about this. There is a sophisticated sort of market cleansing mechanism like that, if you want to call it that, a vetting mechanism. But, you know, nevertheless, to the extent that these are vulnerabilities that could be exploited by other people, if NSA finds itself in the position a couple years from now of having known about a major flaw that gets exploited to cause the big calamity that they're all warning about, they're going to have a very hard time explaining why they didn't do something about it. So that's that delicate, you talk about a balance that you have to strike. That seems to me extremely difficult. And of course, it probably has to be done in secret, because as soon as you expose the vulnerability, it's no longer a secret.
But we could bail out of this market, and the market would be there. We just wouldn't see it.
Well, corporations, I think, would fill it up. I mean, NSA is widely believed to.
What about the PLA?
Sure. I mean, and I'm sure they probably got teams of people just looking for those and finding them a lot faster, those vulnerabilities, because they can throw more bodies at it. But it's definitely the case too that, you know, you take NSA out of the market, you take the biggest buyer of the market, at least as we've come to define it and understand it in the reporting that's been done. But, you know, Google, banks, other corporations would be right behind them.
Well, maybe.
Doing it for more for defensive purposes,
yeah,
but still,
yeah, but,
they're
but, you
buyers.
Know, that's a more of an open market. That is to say, you know what the reward is.
Yeah, more of a gray market than a black market.
Yes, and people that sets a market floor, it seems to me. If you can use this to win a prize in Pwn to Own, then you'll say, okay, this is worth like whatever that is, $125,000. And so I'm not going to sell it on the black market for less than $125,000. And the day I use it to win the $125,000, it's going to get patched by whoever is the victim operating system. So. But if you say to yourself, you know, I bet this guy would want this particular vulnerability and would pay more than $125, then the you know, Google's out of the market.
Right.
They're not going to start negotiating individually with people. And indeed, it's very hard to do that because once you say to them, oh no, you really want to pay more than $125 for this one because it implicates every single operating system you ever had and it will cause total disaster for your enterprise customers. The more you explain that, the more they start to guess what it might be and start looking for it and may find it.
Right, so, find it on their own, so you can tip them off to the thing you're trying to sell them.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm a little skeptical of this because if the market exists anyway, having NSA out of it just means we won't have any weapons except ones we find, which is hard to do, and everybody else will still have them, and the likelihood that and we could go out and buy them and then fix them. But that's an enormous expenditure of federal funds, not for a national security purpose, or not a very significant one, because you buy them, you fix them, and they just develop more. I mean, there's a lot of zero days out there.
Yeah, and you know, on that point about the skepticism of whether this is a workable policy, that those recommendations that the board made, they just said sort of get out of this business of acquiring and hoarding information. They didn't really offer, at least as I could tell, any response in the way of, well, then how is the NSA going to build, you know, the cyber arsenal that I think everybody agrees that it needs to have to do this new kind of security.
That report was put together very fast, and my impression is it was put together by letting each of them pick up, you know, ride their hobby horse.
Yeah. And I don't think they expected the administration to take it up seriously.
And actually, I thought Mike Daniels' blog post was perfectly sensible. You know, yes, sometimes a vulnerability is so bad that you simply cannot afford to let it sit out there, or it's so obvious that somebody else is going to find it and exploit it that you say it's too risky. And some vulnerabilities are so hard to figure out and so subtle that you might be able to use them for a year or two before anybody figures out. And if you say, I will know the day somebody does this because I have sensors that will see that the incoming, and then I can quickly fix it, they'd say, well, that's an ideal vulnerability to exploit. And all of that was buried in his list of factors. The other thing that's happening, though, is the administration has gone to the International Export Control regime, the Wassenaar regime, and asked for a modification that says we will exercise export controls over the sale of vulnerabilities outside of our jurisdiction. And that's kind of treating them like, you know, weapons and imposing weapons arms control or arms export control restrictions. The administration hasn't finished writing those regs, but they're at work on something. I don't know if you've followed that.
No, very tangentially. I mean, this whole question of whether you do treat them as weapons and sort of, you know, the export controls come into play with that. You know, I would imagine there's probably maybe more concern on that aspect of it than there is on the recommendations that the NSA review panel made.
So this is particularly relevant to the rise of Iran as a cyber power, it seems to me. 5 years ago, talking about Iranian cyber hackers was mostly, you know, people would joke about it. Mm-hmm. They didn't treat it seriously. Now it's clear Iran has pulled off some hacks that are pretty impressive and pretty audacious, not only breaking into DigiNotar and bankrupting DigiNotar and stealing a bunch of certificates that they used to fake being Facebook and Google and a whole bunch of other people for the entire population of Iran as a way of finding out who the dissidents were and what their IP addresses were and where they lived. They've also mounted what I think is fair to describe as a calibrated and mocking attack on U.S. banks, shutting them down kind of on a schedule. Oh, by the way, 2 to 4, you won't be working. Sucks to be you. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, if I remember right. Obviously making it plain that they could do a lot more damage if they chose to, but they are really just demonstrating their capabilities and taunting the U.S. with those capabilities.
Yeah, and it was aspirational 5 years ago, and they've developed so fast and gotten so much better than they were when they started. You know, people talk a lot about, when you're talking about cyberspace as a domain of operations, you hear the phrase a lot, that the barrier to entry is very low, that it doesn't take too much to get in, and many people can come in and suddenly be as good as other nation states. Well, Iran is sort of a case study in that. They've gotten very good, very aggressive. I do think that on their part, it's a desire to demonstrate a capability and an asymmetric capability. After Stuxnet, they have every incentive,
right,
to want to do this and to say, hey, we can do this stuff too. Where I think it gets a little bit, you know, for policy, for U.S., on the U.S. side, it gets particularly, you know, nerve-wracking is not because necessarily even that they're so good, because the Russians are very good too, and the Chinese are very good, and we've been dealing with them, but that they seem to be much more likely to use this stuff,
right,
in an aggressive way. And certainly the Chinese have been stealing secrets, but it sort of still stays limited to secrets.
They have not done a lot of sabotage, maybe a little at the margins for non-governmental entities, but you're right. The Iranians don't see that as a limitation. That's just an open market space, a niche that hasn't been occupied, and they intend to occupy it.
And they can use it against their regional adversaries, too. I mean, Saudi Aramco is believed, that the wipeout, right, of the computers there is believed to be an Iranian operation. So they can really exercise this sort of regional force as well. And now, of course, what you see is Saudi Arabia and the UAE and the Emirates and the Gulf building up their own capabilities as well, and U.S. companies are going to help them do that. So everyone is sort of fortifying their positions, I guess, you know. What's interesting in Iran, you know, it's about 2 years ago, the Revolutionary Guard bought the controlling stake in the national telecom company. So here you have, it's a lot like North Korea, this completely centralized, almost shut off from the rest of the world if they wanted to. They could shut off the internet. They've talked about that. So almost sort of like these cyber fortresses, you know, if you
like. Well, this is the Chinese model.
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously much bigger country, and they're much more open to the rest of the world doing business than Iran is, but there's absolutely, I'm sure the Iranians look at that, and they're copying stuff out of the playbook. So, you know, this is, you know, I think that this is, it's just a great case in point when you talk about other nations being able to get into this space and operate in a really sophisticated way that is challenging and that is threatening. You don't have to look much further than Iran, and they're giving us evidence, you know, day after day, it seems, of their willingness and their capability.
So I when I talk about this, I say the model is the 1976 East German swim team. If you want to succeed bad enough in a field, the Olympics tell you exactly how to do it. You go around to the fifth grade of every school in your country, and you find the kids who are best at the thing you want to develop, and you move them all to the capital, and you put them in a special school, and they do nothing but that for 10 years, and at the end of it, you have a very competitive team. And it's not hard for the Iranians. They probably have more fifth graders than the United States does.
Yeah, they employ people. There,
yeah,
you go. It's a jobs program.
So it's not really a surprise that they're that good. The question is, what are they going to do with this? They clearly have pulled back since the peace talks, and if they're thinking about this, they may think that the peace talks were in part a fruit of having demonstrated that a military option was going to come with a lot of pain for the financial sector. They can continue to do this. The U.S. response, we had Chris Painter in here last week. He was very proud of the fact that the denial of service attacks had been partially deflated by going to 23 countries and asking them to take some action against the botnets in their jurisdiction. But he really didn't say it had done an enormous amount to protect the U.S., and it was very painful and so highly unlikely to work if Iran is determined to return to this. Does that mean that kinetic options in the event of a nuclear test are really off the table because of the ability to reach our financial sector?
It could be. I mean, I guess at that point you would have to ask, you know, how far along is their nuclear test and how credible do you think it is they're about to build a missile? But, you know, yeah, sure. I mean, to the extent that they've demonstrated their willingness to retaliate, you have to have that now. It seems to me in the calculus of if you take some kinetic action inside Iran that's, you know, bombing them, I would imagine they would see cyber as one of their first methods of retaliation and response for that. And in a way, they'd be foolish not to, because what else do they have?
Well, that's right. Well, that plus Hezbollah.
Yeah, sure, and, absolutely.
And so they can blow up a lot of stuff.
Can blow stuff up and crash it, absolutely.
Yeah. And do you think the Russians are helping them?
That's a good question. You know, I guess the safe presumption would be yes, sure. And to the extent that that expertise is also available on the market and is sold.
That's right.
Yeah.
Of course, they can buy that expertise from a bunch of Russians without having to go to the Russian government at all.
I mean, the Russians have been very, very sophisticated in creating a whole enterprise for this stuff. I mean, perhaps even more so than U.S. companies have been. So sure. Yeah. You can just buy the expertise.
Yeah. So what does all this mean for foreign policy generally? Where do you see the biggest impact on 21st century foreign policy from the impact of cyber insecurity?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I sort of take the general view that we are really at the very beginning of an emerging narrative that is going to sort of reshape foreign policy and military relations and national security, and it's already reshaped privacy. You know, one of the things that I thought was just an interesting data point, maybe it goes to the answering that question, is, you know, when Chuck Hagel was over in China, you know, a few weeks ago, you know, the United States made a big show about sitting down with their Chinese counterparts and saying to them, well, here are sort of our capabilities in cyber, and here's how we see what the rules of the road are emerging, and here are the things that if we did them, we would not want to know how you perceive that action. And what they're trying to do is formulate some kind of a deterrence, you know, strategy, you know, or a way of signaling to each other the way we have with nuclear weapons. And the Chinese response to that was, thanks very much for the presentation, now go away. And you're not getting anything from us. I mean, to me, this sort of in the near term, and I read about this in the book, the new one, in the next 5 years or so, countries, at least their militaries, have got to come to some understanding about what the signaling is, what the red lines, to use that overuse phrase, are in cyberspace, so that you don't have a miscalculation and a misunderstanding that turns into something, you know, uncontrollable.
So I've lectured on this and thought about it, and I continue to believe the analogy for transformation of warfare is to air power, and the development of air power as both an intelligence tool in World War I and then clearly as a tool for delivering large-scale munitions on civilian infrastructure by the 30s. And all the debates we're having now, they had then. All of the goals they had, they said, oh, well, this is obviously a violation of international law to use these things on civilian populations, so we'll just say it that it is, and people won't do it. And even more so, actually, they really did have a horror of it that we don't fully appreciate, because they'd never had a civilian bombing until World War II. But they'd seen how war had been transformed in the trenches and how awful it was. And the idea that that, you know, bloody enterprise was going to next be visited on the women and children who stayed home was just appalling to the people who lived through World War I. And so they really wanted to stop it. This is, you know, it makes appeasement look a lot more rational than it seems to us now. And they actually did have a kind of understanding right through about the first 9 months of the war, in which everybody agreed that attacking London, attacking Berlin from the air, it's not something you're going to do, that there are civilian populations there. And it was a navigational error. When the Luftwaffe was attacking the docks in East London, and they overflew and they hit the financial sector, and that was it. You know,
yeah.
Churchill said, fine, we're going to drop bombs on Berlin within 24 hours. And that was it. It was all, the gloves were off. And you could say, well, they were signaling to each other that the bombs on Berlin were just a symbol that, you know, you screw up, we can screw up in the same way. But people don't see those signals the same way.
Right.
Hitler said, you've embarrassed me politically. I told people that Berlin would never be harmed, and now you've made me look like a fool. I have to show you that was a bad idea by launching the Blitz.
And I think the U.S. in that same way sees itself that restraint in the face of a lot of these aggressive attacks against U.S. companies is sort of the operating principle. We could hit back and knock out Iranian banks and do all kinds of things.
And that works if you are perceived as the dominant player.
Right.
Restraint by the dominant player is understood as restraint. If it's not clear that you're the dominant power, it's read as weakness.
Yeah. And, you know, and you're already seeing cyber enter into these other sort of little smaller regional conflagrations, right? So the Vietnamese and the Chinese have been trading, you know, attacks, you know, with their hackers, in the midst of this standoff over the oil rig. So
yeah,
at some point it's going to be seen as like, it's okay to add cyber onto this other kinetic standoff that we're having, maybe?
Well, sure. I mean, if I were the Vietnamese, I'd say, you know, nice little oil rig you've got there. It uses an industrial control system, doesn't
Shame
it?
Shame if something happened
to
it.
Yeah, and taking it out would feel like simple justice,
right.
or really less than a kinetic attack.
Sure, and I mean, it might even be seen as, you know, the legal option or the humane option, if we want to think of it that way, because it doesn't cost any lives. You just disable the thing
right.
without having to blow it up. And I think that'd probably be true, sure. So I mean, I think what's going to happen is you're going to see these kinds of norms setting based on all these little cases, which.
Well, if that's the case, we already have a norm that the first thing you attack is the financial system, because both the Iranians and the North Koreans have done that.
Yeah, and we have a norm now that it's okay to, as a method, means of deterring a country from acquiring a nuclear bomb, to sabotage their nuclear plant.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know, and to do it by some fairly sophisticated means. So,
last question. What is your book about? What's it called? When is it out?
Yep, the book is called At War. So it's At Symbol
oh,
War. At
oh,
War.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
I can't believe that hasn't been taken on.
Yeah, I'm very glad that it did. I'm very, very glad we got it. And basically what I'm writing about is something we like to, we're calling in the book the military internet complex. So the idea that, much in the way that, you know, and I'm not writing about it so much with foreboding as much as trying to explain it, but, you know, in the way that Eisenhower sort of articulated in his farewell speech, there's idea that we had this highly professionalized military and an industry building up around defense that we'd never had before. So we're also seeing this sort of conjunction of the military with this technological or internet-based kind of, you know, industry, if you like. So really what I'm looking at is the ways that cyber is used operationally by the military, by the intelligence agencies, and more by corporations. And one of the things that I was not prepared for when I started out writing the book a couple of years ago is the degree to which corporations have become very, very sophisticated actors in this space. On the defensive side, I think they've all essentially, being generalizing here, but realized the government's not coming to our rescue. We're going to have to do security for ourselves. They've gotten very, very good at it, banks especially. And I write a little bit about like what the future might look on the offensive side of things, which is a heck of a lot more murky. For them.
My impression is, while the American companies will be the last to do this, there are already companies in third world countries, big companies that dominate third world countries, that almost certainly are using the same tools without bothering to go through the government. That
sure.
There are private enterprises that will hack your competitor and tell you what his legal strategy, his M&A strategy, or his sales strategy are.
So you could even go to companies in Italy, or, you know, in other places in Europe that manufacture software to do that, and the company says, we're just building the software. What you do with it is entirely up to you. I go into in the book, you know, quite a bit about this whole notion of hacking back, and it, obviously it's a big concern for American companies because it is illegal to hack back.
Well, maybe.
I've had a Justice Department.
Sure. I don't think they have the cojones to actually pursue a company that is genuinely a victim and is trying to at least find out who their attacker is and take their data back. If you were trying to break a bunch of computers someplace,
that's
you'd
different.
Be in trouble. But,
right. But trying to recover stolen property is a different
matter. I think that's right. They'll tell you that it's probably illegal, and they'll be very discouraging. This is... You know, they're 20 years out of date, I think, and I don't believe they'd do it. But you're right. It's scared off the entire Fortune 500 from doing that.
Yeah. I think to me, the really interesting space to watch is, I mean, I talked about this is where we're at the beginning of a story, which actually makes it rather difficult to write a book about it. But the really interesting place to watch, you know, cybersecurity writ large developing, I think, is very in the private sector. I mean, the military is actually getting very professionalized and routinized about it. I mean, they've been a lot more open about it in the past 18 months, particularly post-Snowden, than I think a lot of people realize. There's quite a lot of information in the public domain that you can put together, as I do in the first half of the book, and sort of say, well, what does our cyber armed forces look like? But really, you know, I think it's looking at companies, and obviously they're tremendously vulnerable. It's their data that's being stolen. It's their infrastructure that's being attacked. It is their industrial control systems that are running the power grid.
Right.
So that's really going to be, I think, the interesting space to watch. But what I'm trying to do is sort of, you know, in the book, in a way, to, you know, posit this idea that there is this sort of alliance or convergence between industry and government on this that we should start paying more attention to. And, you know, in much the way that Eisenhower said this is something that's new in the American experience, I think that's true about this as well. It's someplace we should be watching, you know, very closely, as you guys do here, you know, every week on the podcast.
Your book, which is still available, The Watchers, mm-hmm. was a great description of the early days of the war, of the post 9/11 war on terror, and the uses to which technology were put, and in some ways kind of a precursor of the debate we're having now after Snowden.
Yeah, and written all without Snowden documents too. So.
Well, therefore I hope that BitTorrent never gets your new book At War.
Right.
Shane Harris. Shane, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Stuart. I'm a big fan of your podcast, and this is great to be on. Thanks.
It's great. All right. Thank you. This has been episode 20 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. I want to thank Stephanie Roy, Maury Schenk, Michael Vadas, and Shane Harris. We hope you'll join us next week for insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.